Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We're glad you're with us on the show today, and our guest speaking to us from his office is Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. We'd love to have your questions for him during our next half hour. You can call those in to area code 765-496-1999. You can send an email to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon. Good to talk to you as always.
Good afternoon. Good to be here.
I want to ask you something that I talked with Chris McBarnes about on last week's program, and it's kind of a broad question. What do you make of all of the shakeup that's happened within your party thanks to Mike Pence being named Donald Trump's running mate?
Well, it certainly had a domino effect. If you look, you know, when you start to fill all those positions and people look at moving from one position to another. So it's definitely been interesting to watch, that's for sure.
You have been fairly candid about the fact that you think there might have been other, perhaps more qualified people the party could have nominated for president. What do you think now that there's a direct Indiana tie to the national campaign?
Well, I mean, I think it probably, you know, caused people in Indiana to pause and maybe look at it in a little different light. But nationally, I don't know that it really changes much. It's certainly interesting, I think, from our perspective as Hoosiers, and someone who's, you know, worked alongside the governor and you know, on whether you agree or not on issues. So it does give you a different perspective, but I don't think it changes things much in the end.
Now we've got Eric Holcomb at the top of the gubernatorial ticket for your party. He's a former state party chairman. Have you had any sort of relationship with him over the course of time, or do you find yourself in a position of trying to get to know him?
No, I've had a very good relationship with Lieutenant Governor Holcomb, both prior to being Lieutenant Governor and since he was named Lieutenant Governor. So, I'm sure he'll move through the process here of choosing a running mate and a ramped up, very short campaign process leading up to the fall.
What does this mean, do you think, for down-ticket Republicans? Do you think that this is beneficial? Because, of course, there were some questions about the popularity of Governor Pence, and some of that baggage is certainly not held by Lieutenant Governor Holcomb. How do you assess what this does for your party?
Well, it certainly changes the equation. You no longer have an incumbent running, and those issues, although they might still be somewhat on the table, aren't as direct as they were, you know, just a few months ago. So it probably evened the playing field out a little bit, in my estimation. And you have two people running who neither one have occupied the office, and it puts it in a whole different light.
There's, of course, been a lot of speculation about Lieutenant Governor Holcomb's running mate, which you mentioned. What are the qualities that you think it would be beneficial for your party to have in whomever he picks?
Well, you know, I'm sure he has a list of criteria in mind that he's moving through the process. But the one thing that probably stands out to me the most is that this is a little different process than normally choosing a running mate, because he's choosing a running mate for the general election, not necessarily someone to get him through that primary process. So in my mind, if I was him, I would be looking for somebody a little bit more moderate who could appeal to a broader base of voters than someone you might look at, you know, in a primary situation in which you really have to appeal to the right. So I'm not sure that that's what he's going to do or that's how he's viewing it, but that's how I would view it.
A lot has been made in recent weeks about the fact that the last several tickets have all had at least one woman on them, whether it's a lieutenant governor like Sue Ellspermann or Becky Skillman before her, or whether it's somebody running for governor like Jill Long Thompson did a couple of years ago. Do you think it would be beneficial for Lieutenant Governor Holcomb to pick a female running mate?
Well, I'm not sure I look at it in that light. I think regardless, you should just try to find the best qualified person. And if it's a balance there, then it's a balance. And if it's not, perhaps it's not. And I think we just bore witness to that, you know, in which we had a governor and lieutenant governor that, for whatever reason, you know, there was a split that occurred. So they clearly were not on the same page at all times. And I think you need to look for that relationship in which you are on the same page and you do have the same objectives and can work well together. So whether that person's male or female, to me, is irrelevant.
The other guy running for governor, John Gregg, was in your city yesterday. Did you see him or interact with him at all?
I did not, no.
He did some speaking while he was there about some things that you and I have talked about on the show, which is working across party lines, trying to, you know, build relationships rather than take ideological stances, perhaps, that would alienate people. And I wanted to ask you about that in terms of what you think Eric Holcomb should do. Do you agree with that general approach of trying to reach across the aisle a little bit more in whoever's in the governor's office next?
Well, that's always my approach. You know, whether that works on a statewide level, I guess, is a different animal, and I'm probably not qualified to speak to that. But I definitely think it works, and I definitely think it's something that he should consider. You know, all politics is local, as they say, and it certainly works on the local level. So I would think you could take some of that to the state level.
Allow me to use John Gregg to transition our conversation here a little bit, and I should remind our listeners, if you want to get into this conversation, call us at 765-496-1999. We're chatting with Crawfordsville Mayor today, Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton today on Ask the Mayor. You can also email questions to ask@wbaa.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. John Gregg talked yesterday when he was in your town about battling crime, specifically battling drug crime. Let me ask a general question to start. Whoever the next governor is, what do you need from that governor in terms of battling the drug crime problem that you and Lafayette and West Lafayette and Frankfort and a lot of other cities are dealing with?
Well, I think we need a host of things because there is no one magic answer. But the things that come to mind, I mean, obviously, when the legislature ties our hands on funding so many times, you know, it's difficult to fund public safety at the levels at which we should be funding them. So that's probably the first thing that needs to be considered. And then moving away from that, I think the state has to take a very serious look at the criminal justice system and mental health services, because all of those things are tied together. And, you know, as you have someone who may enter the system with a substance abuse issue, it is very, very difficult in the current system to get that person the help they need to break that cycle and get them off of the drug issue. So I think that's where the state really needs to be looking, and they really need to consider how they're approaching that.
I've been looking at some statistics of what's gone on in the city of Lafayette over the last 6 months, because Mayor Rozworski and the police chief here have been working on trying to crack down on some sorts of crime. And a lot of the crimes have gone down, but one thing that's gone up is theft, which is one of the crimes that's directly connected to drug activity. A lot of the police departments will tell you. Have you seen similar increases in Crawfordsville in terms of just that category?
Not of recent. You know, ours has remained fairly stable, but I do hear from the police that, you know, most theft is related to the drug problem. But we've not seen any kind of spike recently. And the only spike that I would say we've seen is, you know, an increase in drug-related arrests, and that's because our officers are really working to be proactive. You know, if you recall, a couple years ago, we nearly doubled the number of officers we have on the street at any given time, and the objective there was, again, allowing them to be proactive rather than reactive, and we've seen that pay off. We've had good, solid arrests, and they work very hard at trying to get out ahead of that drug problem on the street.
Well, and you've been doing more targeted patrols in recent months, have you not?
Yes. The police department has designed patrols around certain times in certain areas to really step up their presence. And again, just send a clear message that this is not welcome here. And this is, you know, we're going to take a serious approach to this. And you know, we still have a problem. There's no doubt about it. But I think we're starting to make some progress.
What have those extra patrols meant for your police staffing? Because you mentioned upping the staffing and getting more officers on the streets a little while ago. Are you getting close to where you're sending more people out in the streets and there are fewer people in the office? How are you dealing with trying to do that?
Well, for us, it's been trying to stay ahead of the battle of keeping our department fully staffed. When we are fully staffed, we have more officers, obviously, to put on the street. And, you know, we can also work with our overtime situation to, you know, beef things up when we need to. But we have been in this constant struggle to replace retiring officers, replace officers who are leaving. You know, and it's not like you go and hire somebody today and put them out there to work tomorrow. It's a very lengthy process of actually hiring somebody, working through vetting them. and then putting them through the training, the academy, coming back and training some more. So, you know, it's easily a year-long process, and we often find ourselves behind in that process, which reduces our number of officers on the street. So we've really focused on trying to stay ahead of the curve there, and that gives us more officers to work with.
Do you also find that you're having to incur some overtime costs to keep these areas that you want more eyes on patrolled as regularly?
Right. At times we do. At times we do. And we've built that into the budget, and the council has been supportive there. We make sure we have the coverage we need when we need it.
There's also been some talk about police departments going to more two-officer cars, because one of the things we're hearing around here from the county sheriff in Tippecanoe County is you have to understand that a lot of the drug crime is leading to more violent crime as well and more violent offenders. And so the police departments seem to believe that there is strength in numbers to doubling up the officers in cars. Have you taken that strategy?
Well, part of our cars run with two people, and that's primarily due to the field training situation. So you will see Carbondale police cars with two officers in it at times. We've not really taken a big step in saying we're always going to have two-person cars. That's not happened yet, and I will definitely follow the lead and the recommendation of the chief and of the officers when they see fit to start making changes there.
You said you hadn't seen a big spike in thefts, but I noticed that yesterday there was a report that came out from the state that said that Indiana is seeing an increasing number of pharmacy robberies, in fact, an alarming number of them. Have your police captains and officers told you this is something you're seeing there as well?
I don't believe we've seen directly that problem here, but I know that they are very aware of it and try to be proactive and, you know, really watching the pharmacies and working with them to take steps to reduce the chances of that happening. So I don't, you know, and maybe there have been that I'm not aware of, but I don't recall that we've seen a big spike in those. But it's something we have to be aware of. We certainly have quite a few pharmacies here in the city.
Let's talk for a few minutes about ways to address some of these problems. One of the things that the Lafayette and West Lafayette police departments do is they funnel all of their crime reports into a single website that helps to map where some of these things are happening. And it's a publicly available website that people can look at. I wondered if you have a similar tool at your disposal to try to give a visual bent to what would otherwise just be seen on paper.
You know, we don't right now, and that's something that we're working on. We have been in transition as far as how our statistics are reported and how we gather all that information and coordinate the information between the sheriff's department and the city police and the town marshals. We're not quite there with that, but that is something that we're aware of, and we would like to be able to post something so people can look at that and make informed decisions on their own. I've looked at Marion County's. I think they've done it very successfully. So it's on the radar screen, but we're not quite there yet.
It would seem like being able to not just put your own information on such a website, but take a look at the reports from other nearby departments that are also using that same database would allow all of your departments to kind of get that big data feel and take a look at where these crimes are happening, what times they're happening, who's involved. Is there that ability to leverage that computing power if you can band together, for instance, with what Lafayette and West Lafayette are doing or what Indianapolis is doing?
Well, I suspect there is. And, you know, I'm sure that those departments are talking. I know they meet on a routine basis, especially when you talk about the drug situation. They do all get together. They do meet. They do discuss, you know, trends and how things are interconnected in all these communities. So whether or not they actually plot this out on the computer, I can't say, but I do know they are communicating.
Some good news. Recently, the county has gotten about $37,000 worth of grants that have been farmed out to a number of different agencies, specifically to help fight substance abuse. Are you hoping that that's the tip of the iceberg? Do you need more grant funding like that to do all the things you want to do?
We need a lot of things, and grant funding is certainly one of those. And you know, as I said, we really are going to have to focus. We've already spent some effort on the enforcement side, but we're going to have to focus on the treatment side and really giving people good, viable options when they want help to break that addiction cycle. So anything and everything we can do along those lines is critically important right now. You know, we have some innovative programs that are occurring, I think, in this community. We had a meeting on one yesterday that helps, in this case, men break that cycle. But it goes a step further, and you know, this plays out over the course of a year, but it starts putting them in the work environment in a very gradual way, build their confidence, build their skills, and they're now they're a, you know, they have a marketable skill when they leave the program, and they've gradually re-entered society, not, you know, just been thrown out there. And you know, you put them in a factory, they've been treated for a few months, and now they're on the line next to somebody with drugs, and it's a tough situation. So this gives them a gradual reentry with a lot of support, and allows them to reintegrate and really build their ability to not fall back into the same trap. So we're trying a lot of different things. Don't have the answer fully, but I think we are making progress.
This is WBAA's Ask the Mayor. Our guest today is Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. We'd love to have your questions for him. Call them into area code 765-496-1999. Send an email to ask@wbaa.org or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. You mentioned some of those treatment programs, and that is indeed where some of that grant funding is going. But it seems to me that one of the issues your community, and you're certainly not alone in this, faces is that you either don't have quite enough treatment centers, or the ones that you do have don't have quite enough beds to treat all of the people who could use the help. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Absolutely.
And so what do you do to try to either get more of them open or expand the existing facilities? I mean, is it purely a resource issue that you just need more money for that?
Well, largely, and that's largely driven by state government and the legislature. And that's, you know, early on when I said we really need some support from them to address this system and address how we are approaching this, the treatment side of this. And it is largely, you know, like I said, driven by the state. So we are looking to them. We are talking with them. There's not much that local government can do in that situation other than create the environment for those things to succeed. So we definitely need some help.
I noticed that one of the bigger grants also went to your police department's canine unit, and I think a lot of us are familiar, at least generally, with the idea of drug-sniffing dogs, dogs well-trained to do things that human officers in many cases cannot do. You talked a little bit ago about trying to interdict some of these things before they even make their way into the community. Do you imagine spending even more resources on canine officers or the canine unit generally to try to put up a barrier to some of these hard drugs like cocaine and heroin getting into Crawfordsville?
We do. And in fact, you know, the council went through the process of creating an additional appropriation just in the last few months to fund another canine, you know, officer. That initially in the early phases in our community had always been privately funded. That's become a little more difficult. Private industry sorts, you know, they kind of look at you and think, well, you know, why are you not paying for this out of your normal police budget? So we've been transitioning that over and increasing our canine presence in the community and doing a very good job with that. It's been very successful already. So will it expand further? It's possible. It's very possible.
One of the things the city of Lafayette is trying to do and has been met with some success, but perhaps not as much as they would like based on the fact that the crime statistics are not falling precipitously, is trying to get more people, more community groups involved, trying to have more meetings at neighborhood houses to get people together and have a police officer attend those meetings. Are you doing something similar to that to not only build those bridges within the department, but also get people to know that, especially in some of these areas you're now targeting with the extra patrols, that you really do care about reducing crime in those places?
We have followed a community policing model for a few years, and we do put officers, you know, in the neighborhoods and at events and hopefully bridge that gap and improve that communication. We've had some success with that, and it's hopefully it's something that we're going to ramp up even more. You know, will we double it? I'm not sure that I can say that, but it certainly will continue to increase based on what we're seeing.
Let's move on to other things. I want to talk a little bit about the city's electric utility. You and I have talked on previous programs about why you had hoped to raise the rates a little bit to try to do some capital improvements. Were you surprised to learn that there was a nearly $1 million operating deficit? So that's why thus you have to put off those additional improvements until you get back in the black there?
Well, not necessarily. You know, what you see there is a cyclical thing, and I feel pretty confident if you look at the report that, you know, within 6 months we should be on relatively solid ground. you know, you just have to remember that, our electric utility went through a very difficult period of time with the Xcel Plus issue and all the things that were going on and the sale of the power plant and all those types of issues. So, you know, when you've not had a rate increase for that long and then you throw those kinds of complex issues on top of it, they went through some very difficult times. So the fact that they find themselves in a tight spot right now is not surprising, but I feel like they are on the path. If you look at the report, within a few months they will be through that situation and they can really start to look at those capital improvements.
Is there any worry that in the time it will take to get back in the black financially, that some of the aging infrastructure that you wanted to fix or replace breaks or gets dangerous or doesn't serve the people well? Are you worried about that at all?
No, we're not worried. The crews here do a great job, and they've really been out there with preventative maintenance and working on things. And when something goes wrong, they always have a backup in place, and we will make sure it's funded and we keep the system operating, because it's not just a matter of, you know, we want the lights to come on in our house. It's very important to all the jobs and the business and industry in our community. If we have power outages, it is very, very costly for them. So we have a very good system in place in making sure we're covering our bases. We're going to make it much, much better with these capital improvements. But in the meantime, the power will stay on.
You mentioned on a previous show, kind of offhandedly at the time, that you were looking into whether the fact that the city's golf course was losing a surprising amount of money had anything to do with financial malfeasance on the part of the people who worked there. And now it seems that may actually have proven to be the case. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. And sadly, you know, we hate to ever go through that situation. We've known for some time that our golf course was financially not stable. We went through, the city council and I went through, you know, went to great effort to try to sort that out and to get that on the right path. We've taken a number of steps. Some of them have been successful, others have not. And, you know, as part of that process, we found some irregularities, and we asked the State Board of Accounts to conduct an investigation. And they've concluded their investigation, and criminal charges have been filed.
So what do you do now to ensure that doesn't happen again?
Well, the first thing, I mean, obviously we've had some significant staffing changes at the golf course, and then we just, you know, really take and understand what happened and take the guidance we receive from the investigators, both law enforcement and State Board of Accounts, and make changes to our system so that we know we have some checks and balances, we know we have some internal controls there, that the same kinds of things cannot happen again.
Did this cause you at all to ask the State Board of Accounts to do any sort of larger investigation into the city's finances to see if there were any other places where this might have been happening, be it on a, maybe even on a smaller level?
Well, we just completed our audits from the State Board of Accounts for the last 2 years within the city, and there was no finding that there was, you know, any problem at all in any other area of city government. This seemed to be an isolated type of thing. We did ask them to look across the board at everything during their audit, and they did do that and came back and said that everything looked fine. This just seemed to be focused in on this one area. And really what you had there was that the city had policies as far as internal controls that weren't necessarily getting handed, you know, down and followed in these departments, such as the golf course. And at the time, the golf course was under independent golf course authority operation. And so there were several layers there in which things could get confused or distorted or not carried out. We've cleaned up that process, and those internal controls are in place, and we monitor those very closely.
To the best of your understanding, how long had that alleged embezzlement been going on?
You know, I'm not sure that I can really answer that question. You know, there was an investigation that looked back, I think, 3 years.
So the logical question I have then is, had there been a State Board of Accounts audit at any point in the past that missed that?
There had not, no.
Okay. So let's go on to a couple other things in just our last 2-3 minutes here. You and I talked some months ago when applications were being taken for the Regional Cities Initiative, and you mentioned that Crawfordsville and Greater Lafayette were trying to come to some sort of application. That never ended up panning out, in some part because you said there were worries about who was going to control the projects and who was going to control the money. I'm curious to know, have you had ongoing conversations with the folks up here in Tippecanoe County about trying to do that again and trying to have a more harmonious process going forward that links these nearby communities economically?
I have not. And I've not heard much about it since that time. Now, that's not to say that maybe they've reached out to our economic development folks or something like that. That's very possible. But I've not been involved in any conversations looking at, you know, how we put together something for the future there. Not aware of anything.
There were, of course, three of those $42 million grants eventually handed out by the state. That was even one more than was initially budgeted for. Do you feel that you missed an opportunity there that really could have helped, or do you think that the agreement as it was would not necessarily have benefited Crawfordsville as much as you like?
Well, I'm not sure that the way that was designed would have a dramatic effect on Crawfordsville. You know, and keep in mind that we were at the time and still are, very deep into stellar and stellar transformation. So that really has our attention and is really directly going to transform our community. I'm not sure that changes in another community have an effect, but I'm not sure that they are that overwhelming in our community. So, you know, we also find ourselves in a very difficult situation there, and I've said this before. It's not like we're clearly aligned with one region. In some regards, we're more aligned with the Indianapolis area. In some regards, we're more aligned with the Lafayette area. So it's not that we are just directly, it's automatic. You know, if there's changes in Lafayette, it directly affects Crawfordsville. That's not necessarily true. There are a good percentage of this population in Crawfordsville that never goes to Lafayette, you know, has no interaction in Lafayette whatsoever. When they go out of town, they're going to Indianapolis. So it's a little murky. It's not cut and dry.
We've also talked on this program about getting all of the economic development folks there in town kind of into one room on one floor of one office building there. Mm-hmm. Do you mean to say that you're kind of focusing more inwardly now, where all of those folks are now just looking about how can we help ourselves rather than how can we align with some other metro area?
No, I don't think that I'm saying that exactly. I'm saying, you know, as you make these community transformations, you know, and you're doing physical work in a community, you're transforming a part of the community. I'm not sure that spins off into the other areas as much as, you know, maybe we would like to think. But the economic development piece, I think you do have to approach with some sense of a regional approach. And we are engaged in conversations right now, both with the Lafayette region and with the Indianapolis region, because we see ourselves at different times aligning with each one, depending on what we're talking about. So you do have to communicate there. And our economic development people do communicate very well with the folks in Tippecanoe County and Lafayette, and they communicate very well with the folks in Marion County and Indianapolis.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, that's the time we've got. It's flown by, but thanks as always for your time and for joining us. And we'll look forward to talking again next month.
Thank you very much.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember, we'll have our conversation next week with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis at this same time. You can submit questions in advance of that show by going to our Twitter handle. That's WBAA News. You can also email ask@WBAA.org with your questions. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.